طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fahm, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. Today we discuss the current state of Palestinian leadership and how Palestinians are contending with multiple layers of authoritarian rule: Israel, the Palestinian Authority, and Hamas. What are the challenges to Palestinian liberation? What roles, positive and negative, do the Palestinian Authority and Hamas play? What role does Palestinian civil society play in mobilizing against Israel and the PA? What can Palestinian resistance to Israel look like? What is behind Hamas's rise in popularity since the most recent escalation with Israel? What is the status of the uprising against the PA, and how is it part of a larger struggle? Laura Friedman of the Foundation for Middle East Peace leads discussion with Tariq Bakoni and Inez Abdul Razak. We begin with introductions.
Today we are going to discuss the current state of Palestinian leadership and how Palestinians are contending with multiple layers of authoritarian rule, Israel, the PA, and Hamas, and how this figures into the quest for Palestinian liberation. I am delighted today to be joined by Inez Abdurazak. Inez is the Advocacy Director for the Palestine Institute for Public Diplomacy, PIPD, which is an independent Palestinian organization. She is also a member of Ashebaka, which is an amazing resource people should know well. Prior to joining PIPD, Inez held advisory positions in the executive offices of the Union for the Mediterranean in Barcelona, the UN Environmental Program in Nairobi, and the Palestinian Prime Minister's Office in Ramallah, where she focused on international governance and development cooperation policies. We are also delighted to have with us Tariq Bakoni. Tariq is Crisis Group's Senior Analyst for Israel-Palestine and Economics of Conflict. His research relates to the contemporary geopolitics of the region with a focus on Israel-Palestine, and his book, Hamas Contained: The Rise and Pacification of Palestinian Resistance, came out in 2018, and everybody should read it. It is fabulous. So, with that, we're going to dive right in. I've organized my questions sort of thematically because we want to cover a lot. So I want to start out by talking about the concept of liberation. And Tara, I want to start with you. So what does liberation mean for Palestinians? Liberation from whom? Does it mean just Israel, or does it also increasingly mean the PA? Liberation in order to achieve what precisely and for whom? And finally, this is a big question, where does today, or doesn't, the one state, two state debate fit into this question?
Thank you, Laura, for the introduction and for having me on this panel. And it's wonderful to be here with Inez. And just to say thank you also to the rest of the FMEP team. I think this is a great discussion and a really timely one to be had now. So I think in answer to your question, there's a very technical answer, and then there's a more philosophical answer. So the technical answer is, when we talk about liberation, we really mean for Palestinians to be liberated from structures of occupation and domination that control every aspect of their life. So that's the simplest way to think about what liberation means, to be able to live as human beings in the land of their ancestors in Palestine. Now, that means the dismantling of the system of domination that the Israeli state maintains over Palestinians, whether within Israel itself or within the OPT or also the Palestinians in exile. but it also means dismantling the systems, the Palestinian systems that are used to enforce that occupation, including the PA, which is the product of the Oslo Accords, as we know, which is a system that has been put in place initially, possibly to lead to statehood, but since then has become a part and parcel of the Israeli occupation and the Israeli military regime. So in the most basic sense, that's what we mean by liberation. But I think there's also a philosophical answer here. And this is something that is harder to encapsulate and think about in the political sense of dismantling occupation or dismantling Israeli domination, which is to say that all the people who are living in Israel-Palestine today are living under a form of apartheid. And that's not just Palestinians. Israeli Jews are implicated in that system, and they are victims of that system in different ways, of course, than Palestinians. But they're all implicated in a regime of apartheid. So liberation, in essence, means to be able to exist in that land beyond that form of governance, which is based on a racial, ethnocentric view of the world. So liberation in the philosophical sense, I think, is being able to, for all the people in that land, to come into their fullest form of humanity, to be seen as human beings living all aspects of their life without prejudice and without oppression. Now, for me, the one state, two state debate is a side element. It's a red herring to this discussion. The point isn't now to focus about whether that kind of liberation can exist in one state or two states. The point really is in confronting that system of oppression. What political framework the emancipated people will then decide to be ruled by is their own thing to figure out in the future. But the debate in itself, I think, has acted as a way to stifle what should be the focus of the struggle, which is this struggle for liberation. And just the final point I want to say is, you know, to what end? You're saying liberation to what end? It's liberation to the end of self-determination, for the people to be able to live in and under systems of governance that are democratic and just and peaceful. And that's the point of what liberation is. I think that's the quest that Palestinians are trying to lead in the land between the river and the sea.
Thanks, Tarek. That's a great place to start. Inez, I want to ask you the same question, the same set of questions, but I also want to ask you to take it in the direction of where you see the Palestinian nation, whether you define that as the people, the leaders, the refugee, the diaspora, or all of those. Where do you see them pushing this question of liberation? What is the end game, and what is the framework in which they are thinking about this?
Thank you, Lara, and really pleasure to be with you all, and thanks for the invitation. I mean, to follow up on what Tarek was saying, it's important to remind that you asked 10 Palestinians of their opinions on what, you know, necessarily emancipation look like or liberation, and you will have 20 opinions. So it's hard to summarize that there is one way the people think about this. I think what is very clear is that there is a colonial dimension and reality. And I think often in the way this, you know, Palestine and the Palestinians has been, and Israel has been, imagined and thought over the past 100 years, often we kind of tend to erase, and we have erased the settler colonial aspect of what has been happening. And I think this is very important, because I think the colonial framing can help understand what's going on in historic Palestine and Israel as something that's not necessarily unique in history. And so I think emancipation and liberation is clearly getting free from that colonial domination and from that colonial system. And that means that settler colonialism and colonialism creates all kinds of layers of ways people perceive themselves, perceive the other. So, for example, you have a lot of Palestinians who, you know, will end up being obliged to have jobs in the settlements or within Israel. And they will tell you, you know, if you ask them point blank, and that's very much of an Israeli talking point, right? Oh, but, you know, they have good jobs in Israel. They earn more than in the West Bank. All of that is clearly, I think, a symptom of the colonial domination. So you have all kinds of symptoms to that, whether it's, you know, wanting to confront the colonial domination, being subsumed to it, being complicit and kind of becoming part of it, as the PA has become. So all of this, you know, is part of today of the Palestinian fabric, things that you have to deconstruct in different ways because people have been kind of dominated in different ways and have responded in different ways to it. But it's all part of that same complex system of domination. And so I think it's very different if you ask a Palestinian in the diaspora or in a refugee camp from a Palestinian in the West Bank or a Palestinian in Gaza. And what the reality we're living under is doing is that it has fragmented geographically, socially, but also has created these layers and tiered system, right, of administration and control over Palestinians that is different, whether you're in Gaza, in the West Bank, in Jerusalem, or a Palestinian citizen of Israel. So I would say that eventually for many people today, they see that the first thing we need to do is unify, is this, you know, this importance of unity, that we are one people, that whether you are decide to be a parliamentarian in the Knesset or a PA employee or you're completely independent and fighting in a, you know, in a grassroots organization, somehow we're part of one people and we need to be able to move beyond these systems that we live under, these systems of governance that we kind of have to live with, but we need to confront together and as one people. And so I think that's what I think is transpiring from today's reality. But I would say that there is a lot of question marks on how would that looks like. And I will just end by saying, I think obviously in the past centuries, you know, even us at school, and I think in our framing, nation state remains kind of the automatic way of emancipation, right? Like this thing that the Europeans and you know, even in Africa or in many, many continents in Latin America, you sort of had like independence from colonization through the creation of nation states. But even before that, starting 15th century, kind of people, you know, kind of seeing the nation state as the model. And I think we're in this moment where we have to extract ourselves from that only path. And unfortunately, we're imposed that path by, you know, the current framing, right? Like the two-state solution is the only solution, or, you know, we need an independent state as the kind of supposed only solution that would be available.
There's so much packed in there that I want to unpack. I will say one of the most striking things about this moment in time is the greater traction that the framing, the talking about this in colonial terms, has suddenly, really quite suddenly taken on outside of Palestinian circles, which opens up, I think, a much more honest discussion about what's happening on the ground than maybe we've ever had. And Palestinians have always talked in those terms, but I think it's finally sort of outside of Palestinian circles, in large part because on the ground, Israel has largely ceased pretending that there is any plan to give up the land and for the Palestinians to have any sort of liberation at all. Inez, I want to follow up with you. In pursuing this liberation, however one defines it, a key question that always comes up is leadership. Right? You know, who leads Palestinians? To what extent today do Palestinians, and again, as you said, 10 Palestinians, 20 different answers depending on their circumstances, but to what extent do Palestinians in any circumstance see the PA or even the PLO as representing them? And on what is this legitimacy of leadership or lack of legitimacy of leadership grounded? And also, I'm curious your thoughts, how this has changed, how this answer has evolved. Right, from the Yasser Arafat era, where there was sort of a general consensus of legitimacy, to a proto-state occupation outsourced body of the PA. How has that evolved over time?
Yeah, so I would say first differentiate between what we mean by leading and controlling. And so I think a lot of Palestinians today think that they have no leaders. They have people who control and who have the power, but that's very different from leading. And as you say, I think since, Yasser Arafat still had this aura, consensus around him before Oslo, I would say, because Oslo also changed that. But definitely, I think the majority of people today think that they have no leadership and that the people who control and who have the power that are mainly in the PA, because the PLO has been kind of dissolved or fusion with the PA, and the few people who have power are kind of wear both hats. I think people do want leadership. I'm not an anarchist myself, and to be honest, I don't think the Palestinians are either. I think people want some form of democratic governance, even if they want to have a say in the decision making. They want leaders. They want to see that there are people who are kind of voicing their rights and again voicing their right to freedom, to liberation. And so I think that's clearly non-existent. And unfortunately, again, the PLO has lost completely its means and its meaning. And I think its legitimacy. The institutions are still there, but very much emptied. And the PA has taken all the power. But the PA, again, was also created out of this colonial idea and is effectively, a subcontractor of the occupation. And so the PA was supposed to be a temporary administration and doesn't have sovereignty. It's only, kind of administrating services that the Israelis don't want to administer to people who are occupied. So, the PA was not supposed to be the political address that it has become. And so I think there is a clear need for change. And I think most people see that. However, I would still say that we have to be realistic. There is a lot of patronal or, clientelist or kind of, I think, again, power dynamics where you have a lot of people that are still kind of loyal or are somehow, following still this factional the factional politics or the kind of family or geographical, not so geographical, but really family kind of oriented traditional politics. So if your father or in your whole family is kind of Fateh, then you might be more, attuned to be kind of following still and be loyal to Fateh. Also because you have these protection mechanisms. Like, again, you're talking about a political space that's very much also corrupt, but corrupt in a sense that people, there are protection mechanisms and there are somehow all these social dynamics that it has created, socioeconomic dynamics that people also have to extract themselves from. So again, if you ask someone tomorrow, they might just say I will follow this group, this faction, this leader, because of a very short-term interest that they have. So I think that's also one thing that we have to extract ourselves from and deconstruct. And I think that's also very much of a challenge.
Thank you. And Tara, can I ask you more or less the same question? The credibility of leadership, who people look to for leadership if they do. But can you also focus on Hamas and how Hamas figures into this Palestinian struggle for liberation, including how it secures legitimacy, how it has historically secured legitimacy, and how it seeks to retain legitimacy now that it's in an administrative role, much like the PA?
I mean, in some ways, a lot of the dynamics that Ines was just talking about are replicated in Hamas. The patronage system that Ines talked about when it relates to Fatah and the PLO exists, obviously, with Hamas and Hamas's membership. So there's very much at the core of it an infrastructure that Hamas has built over the years, even before its establishment as its parent organization, the Muslim Brotherhood, had built, that is rooted in Islamist social and charitable work that has created networks of families and members being aligned with the movement, almost regardless of the movement's political ideology. So there is that kind of patronage system that exists as the base. But as a movement, Hamas had initially developed its legitimacy much in the same way that the PLO had, as a movement that was committed to armed struggle along with other anti-colonial movements globally to fight a colonial regime, in this case, a Zionist regime or Israel. So it derived its legitimacy in much the same way that the PLO had before it. The difference being that with Hamas, that ideology was grounded in an Islamist framing. So the idea was that this armed struggle was also rooted in an Islamist ideology, derived its justification theologically. So not just in terms of its relation with other anti-colonial movements globally. Now, two things happened since Hamas's sort of earliest manifestations and today. The first is that the PLO has shown Hamas what not to do, which is to compromise. It has shown Hamas that if you give up on your right to resist militarily what is a military regime, then you will not benefit. Actually, that compromise is going to get you to lose your power in that battlefield. So in some ways, the PLO and subsequently the PA has shown Hamas the futility of letting go of armed struggle before some kind of political achievement has been secured. But the second thing is that Hamas has now, in its own way, played around and experimented with both administration, as you say, in the Gaza Strip, but also with what other forms of getting legitimacy or getting resistance might look like, including positioning itself as a party that might engage with popular struggles. And we can talk about that in a second. But ultimately, the core for Hamas remains armed resistance. And this was very clear in May. You know, when we had an episode where Israel and the Israeli authorities in East Jerusalem was for weeks, if not months, before the escalation transported to the Gaza Strip, we had Israeli forces using force against what were generally peaceful protests by Palestinians. When Hamas responded to that using rocket fire, that was a major boost to its legitimacy because Palestinians saw that as finally a Palestinian movement, a Palestinian faction able to defend them against Israeli aggression. And even though, you know, much of the discourse in the international community was that now Israel has to act in self-defense against Hamas, from the Palestinian perspective, more than 500 Palestinians had already been injured in Jerusalem before Hamas fired its own rocket. So actually, it was Hamas acting in self-defense against Israeli aggression on behalf of Palestinians. Now, that formulation means that for Hamas as a military party, it still gets a significant boost and a boost in its popularity through its use of armed struggle. So regardless of what that armed struggle is for, and we can also talk about Hamas's objectives in using those rockets, just in terms of popularity on the street, that is a major wave in which the movement derives its legitimacy, and it becomes even more so when it's compared to the PA, which is explicitly against armed struggle and explicitly committed to security coordination and to the maintaining of Israeli sort of hegemony in the West Bank.
Thanks. And that actually dovetails well with where I want to take this next, which is that question of tactics. And, you know, when I think about this, you know, one of the things that's striking to me is that the, you know, giving up of armed struggle was basically the deposit. It was the absolutely non-negotiable deposit that Arafat and the PLO made in order to come into a diplomatic process. And I think it's striking that Palestinians, that the Palestinian leadership, the PLO and the PA have stood by that, even as diplomacy and negotiations have actually proven to be a path to losing more and more Palestinian interests, not gaining them. Sadek, I want to stay with you for a second and first talk about Hamas, and then Inez, I want to focus in on the PA and PLO with you. But with Hamas and the the refusal to give up armed struggle. But by the same token, Hamas isn't constantly engaged in armed struggle. It's very tactical, right? When they choose to engage, how they choose to use their rockets, what their specific objectives are for when they start and stop. Can you talk about those tactics and those calculations and how those play with the Palestinians in Gaza, but also more broadly? I think for people on the outside, the idea that Hamas sort of comes in, you know, in a given moment and engages with weapons, which, I mean, shooting rockets into, you know, shooting rockets into populated areas of Israel, which qualifies as terrorism under international law, no question, you know, doing that and then bringing down the full wrath of the IDF, which is not, again, it's not, that's not a, I don't want to suggest that it just started at the moment of Hamas rockets, but that's how it's seen by the world. How does that play for Palestinians tactically when Hamas is looking at its own objectives in the Gaza Strip and more broadly?
The first thing to say is that Hamas, as you rightly say, has always engaged with armed struggle tactically. So the point of armed struggle was always to achieve certain goals, much in the same way that Israel uses its own force. And for Hamas, that was deterrence. It was to do two things through its use of armed struggle. The first is to deter Israel from carrying out acts of violence against Palestinians, which is the dynamic that we saw in Jerusalem in May. But the second, and this is an earlier iteration of Hamas's use of armed struggle, specifically around the Second Intifada, was to inflict sufficient pain on Israeli civilians that they forced their government to relinquish their hold over the occupied territories. So in that sense, there was a very specific goal for Hamas's use of armed struggle. And through the many iterations that the movement has gone through over the years, that has evolved. I think now there's very much the sense that militarily, actually, using armed struggle in the way that it was, let's say, used in the Second Intifada is not going to shift the balance of power on the ground. Israel militarily is a lot more capable. There's no point in sort of stressing that. There's no comparison between the military arsenals of both actors, but also that there are other questions that come to the fore, including questions related to attrition, related to the morality of using these forms of armed struggle, and the sort of the broader strategic implications of what it means for Palestine and Palestinians for that armed struggle, given the very effective framing by Israel and by the West that Palestinian anti-colonial struggle can account or amount to terrorism if armed struggle is enforced. Now, having said that, Hamas has experimented both discursively and practically in popular struggles. So it has certainly under Khaled Mash'al openly spoken about its intention to move away from armed struggle and into popular resistance. And under Yahya Sinwar has actively supported popular mobilization, including in the Great March of Return in Gaza, which is the broadest, most politically diverse and one of the most longest sustained forms of mobilization in Palestinian history. The response to that were twofold. The international community ignored both Khaled Mash'al's readiness to take the movement in that direction and the Great March of Return, which happened with Hamas approval. But not only did they ignore them, They allowed Israel to respond, certainly in the Great March of Return, using live fire against unarmed civilians for weeks, and framed those responses as self-defense by Israel. So not only did the popular protests not get international support, they failed to shift the balance or the frame that the international community understands what's happening on the ground. It's the framing of terrorism still held, even though the protests were peaceful for weeks before incendiary kites and balloons were used, and Israel was using live fire against medics and media personnel and unarmed civilians, causing loss of life and grave harm, according to the International Criminal Court. Even despite those international investigations, the framing was still that Israel was facing hordes of Palestinians fighting to break into its border, attack Israelis. This was a form of terrorism that was guided by Hamas. So again, the lessons here for Hamas are that actually that form of popular mobilization doesn't work. You know, when Palestinians want to engage in popular mobilization, they're often thinking, and this is where it also moves beyond Hamas. Palestinians, certainly those engaged in, let's say, the latest events in Jerusalem, often believe that popular mobilization is going to get international support, that if there is an anti-apartheid movement by Palestinians, the international community is finally going to understand what's happening and come down hard on Israel. The reality is not that, is very different from that. The reality is that until Israel bleeds, until it faces the harm of military resistance, historically it hasn't acted in any kind of way that allows for concessions, but also that the international community doesn't notice and doesn't shift. And it's also a misreading of the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa, which suggests that it was driven by a popular mobilization and boycotts and not by armed struggle. So all this to say that for Hamas, but also for Palestinians more broadly, there is a genuine need to understand where military force works, where it doesn't. Obviously, to reiterate the point you said, that it has to be in accordance with international law. And by the way, international law gives the right to anti-colonial movements to use force against violent colonial regimes. So how does military force work? In what effect, what are its effects strategically, but also morally? What does it mean to our process of liberation, as Ines was talking about, if military force is part of the equation? But those questions are serious questions, and they can't just be dismissed by sort of accusations of terrorism.
Yeah, I mean, it's just listening to you, I'm thinking about the president of Israel referring to Ben and Jerry's pulling out of settlements as economic terrorism. I think a lot of us for years have observed that, you know, those of us who do not want to see armed struggle as dangerous for both sides and don't want to see terrorism. But at the point when you say, well, you know, economic pressure is terrorism, diplomatic pressure is terrorism, journalists writing articles that are critical is terrorism, everything is terrorism, it's sort of like, all right, we're going to deprive the Palestinians of every possible route to resist nonviolently. We'll call it all terrorism. And then if they resort to armed struggle of any kind, that is terrorism, done. It seems to be a very clear calculation there. So Ines, I want to take the same question to you, and I want to talk about the calculations of PA and the PLO with respect to tactics here. How does, again, we said the PLO and PA gave up armed struggle as part of coming to the table, were lauded by the international community for doing so, wonderful, and they've stuck to that, which they're lauded for as well. How does this leadership strategize about resistance? How does it identify and deploy its chosen tactics to advance Palestinian liberation when we now have decades that showing that the tactics that have been left available to them don't work, and to the extent that they might have any bite are then called terrorism anyway? And how does the PA and the PLO, how is it able to maintain its commitment to refrain from armed resistance, which I actually think is a good idea, but how does it do that and have legitimacy when it's increasingly seen, as you said, as the subcontractor for occupation?
I think the question is, do they strategize? I have, clearly, obviously, we all have doubts about this, unfortunately. And I was just, all of this conversation just, you know, it makes me think that we talk about Hamas and the PA and PLO, but we have to realize that what's happening now is that Palestinians who very much want also freedom, liberation, are not part of that equation. Like the Palestinian citizens of Israel, so the Palestinians of 48 and the refugees in diaspora have been kind of ignored, although Hamas has some presence, Fatah has some presence in refugee camps outside. However, they're kind of forgotten in the whole overall strategy, I think, of the people in power. So I think, you know, the PLO and PA, I think the few people now who clearly have the power, I think we're very much in an autocratic system and regime where you have very few people taking the decisions. And the both in their discourse and I think in their actions, it's very clear that they are abiding by the status quo, as in collaborating with the current occupation. That includes security coordination. That includes obviously all kinds of coordination, because the PA only can exist if it continues to abide by the Oslo regime, which is effectively maintaining Palestinian under the dependency and very much hegemony, as Tariq said, of Israel, whether it's for trading, importing, exporting, having water, electricity. You know, the PA buys its electricity from Israel, our own water in the West Bank, which comes from an underground aquifer, is controlled by Israel, and then Palestinians buy the water. So I think all of these systems in place make that the Palestinians, for the PA, for its very own kind of survival, needs to abide by the system. So they're kind of trapped in their own domination. And I think the people in power obviously want to keep the power. I think that's their thinking. I think they're very much disconnected from their people, very much so. And I think they are accountable to the people who have power over them, which is Israel and also the US. And to some extent, you know, the Europeans, although they have a bit less of an influence, but it's a major donor. So I think it's very clear for Palestinians that when Biden was elected, the reactions from, you know, the Palestinian leadership of suddenly giving signals like we want to go back to negotiations or things like that, again, things that are very disconnected from the political reality, it was a very clear timing. It was very explicit. Again, in fact, like the PA and PLO leadership continues to really repeat that they're ready to talk and sit down with Israel for talks, for negotiations. In clearly, whether it's a moment or at least I think most Palestinians realize that having entered that bargaining chip of entering bilateral negotiations was clearly not going to work because of the asymmetry of power among the parties. You have people who participated in Oslo today. Khalil Tafakji, he's a cartographer and he mapped, and he was the only technical person coming with maps and saying, you know, you're not going to have two states with what they're suggesting. But at the end, the Israelis were coming with their own maps and the negotiations were made based on the maps that the Israelis were coming with. And things only got worse. So today you have Israel that has all the cards and Palestinians who have none, except, as Tariq said, armed struggle. Like arms violence is one of the only leverage that the Palestinians unfortunately have. And so I think we're in that moment where basically the PA leadership knows that they have no legitimacy and they probably have no strategy, but they want to maintain their power. And the external influence to maintain that status quo, because of the focus on Israel's interest in security, is very powerful. We shouldn't discard that when we discuss, obviously, Palestinian political space, agency, or any form of political leadership or institutions. You have to look at what's going on in the US, in the UAE, and in Saudi Arabia, and those interests, because they're very much influence than how the political dynamics are playing.
So hold that last thought, because I want to come back to that in a couple more rounds, because that's really important. I want to actually follow up on something you both had mentioned, which is the idea of popular resistance separate from the leadership. And Tara, I want to come back to you for a moment and talk about this. And as I'm going to go back and forth again. So Tara, So occupation has been reality for 54 years. Obviously, the structures of Oslo have not changed that. In fact, they've actually allowed it to deepen and become stronger, more entrenched, more permanent. So at this point, what does Palestinian popular resistance, separate from the leadership, look like? And where does the debate stand specifically when it comes to the legitimacy and efficacy of unarmed versus armed struggle against Israel, again, at the popular level? And you talked about the March of Return. That's a great example. But even more broadly, how do Palestinians perceive, whether you want to say the advantages or the pitfalls of the various tactics that are available to them as people on their own struggling for their rights?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I think that what popular resistance looks like, I think we just need to look at the events of May and June. I think that's in some ways what it looks like. It looks like mobilization in different ways in different areas. In some places, it's, iftar, prayer, sit-ins. In other places, it's protests and mass mobilization. In third places, it's mobs and more active sort of forms of engagement and confrontation with Israeli Jews. And so I think that when we're thinking about what popular protests look like, I'm thinking of them as protests or mobilization that's happening on the street level, sort of unorganized, organically. I think May, June offers a very good example of what that looks like. Now, there's a lot of things that we can pull out of those 2 months. The first, I would say, is that popular mobilization, by default now, we have to see as breaking out of the structures of partition. So we have to see not as popular mobilization happening in the West Bank or in the Great March of Return, but actually as mobilization that's happening by Palestinians wherever they are, as a single people fighting a single regime. Now, that was maybe sort of the culmination in May, June, but it's been happening for years. You know, the land protests in Israel or the land protests in Lebanon, Lebanon's refugee camps, or the Great March of Return, we're all talking about the same thing, which is return. And fighting Israel's settlement and colonization of Palestinian land. So there's been that kind of popular mobilization happening historically for Palestinians since pre-Israel. And I think that that continues to this day. The format of it is clear. Now, in that popular mobilization, I think often, and this is where I think there's a naivety that comes in, often the sense is that those protests have to be peaceful or have to be nonviolent, or this is the only way that those protests can have legitimacy. And I think that's a reductionist way of understanding the kind of popular mobilization against a regime that is militarized and that is lethal. So expecting that kind of popular mobilization to not engage in acts that become violent, either in self-defense or otherwise, becomes expecting the impossible out of that kind of organization or that kind of mobilization on the street level, just by default. And we've seen that time and again during the intifadas, during the Great March of Return. So the threshold that's put on that kind of mobilization for Palestinians, I think, is designed to undermine the legitimacy of any kind of mobilization against either Israel or the PA security forces, which act in cahoots with Israel. Now, I just to answer specifically your question, how do people feel about the different tactics? You know, protesters in Jerusalem, when Hamas fired its first rockets, I think there were two general schools of thought. The first was this sense of betrayal, that Hamas was now coming in to co-opt what was otherwise a peaceful movement, and this is going to be used for its own factional interests, and this is going to undermine Palestinian achievements on the international stage. Palestinians had already caused the Supreme Court to delay its decisions, to reroute the march. What Hamas is doing is problematic. The other school of thought was, good, there's been 500 Palestinians injured and there's no showing from Israel that this will cease. We need Israel to be slapped the same way that Palestinians are being slapped. And the only faction that has our back is Hamas. And actually, there's truth to both those sides. You can argue both ways. And I think personally, I look at this and understand that popular mobilization is one tactic and there isn't a silver bullet. Armed resistance on its own isn't going to work. Peaceful protests on their own aren't going to work. BDS on its own isn't going to work. The ICC on its own isn't going to work. This is a liberation struggle, and by default, it has to be multifaceted. It has to encompass different ideologies and different tactics, all mobilizing for the same vision, So ultimately, we need, just in the same way that we need to understand Hamas as being part and parcel of the Palestinian liberation movement, so is someone who is committed to an anti-Islamist peaceful protest in Nablus. Those two people can, or organizations can, be mobilizing towards the same goal. And I think this is, you know, when we think about what popular mobilization looks like, we need to think of it as one form of resistance against Israel. And that needs to be one part and parcel of a multifaceted struggle for liberation.
You have been listening to a discussion of Where Palestine Goes Next with Laura Friedman, Inez Abdel Razak, and Tariq Bakoni. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here every week at the same time and place on your radio dial. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. To access our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. This archive was developed and is maintained by our colleague and sound engineer, Stan Robinson. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is John Roberts, wishing you a good morning. من مخيم إلى